foreigners, including five Iranian exchange students. As families of the victims and their supporters marched to the presidential office, they again called for truth and justice and a proper memorial to their lost loved ones. Frank Smith, Seoul.
For most people in Gaza, it's just a dream to travel and explore the world outside the Israeli cruel blockade. The new generation has lived almost all its whole life under the Israeli siege, learning about the world only through screens. The longest-standing Israeli restriction on the movement of people and goods to and from Gaza has undermined the living conditions of over 2 million Palestinian residents.
The idea of this festival is that children of Gaza rarely travel abroad, and it's hard to get out of Gaza to discover the countries around the world. We sought to bring the world's countries to our children and introduce the different cultures through a collection of famous Flint statues, food and clothes, cultures in general.
Al-Amal Institute for Orphans in Gaza is an independent non-governmental organization that pursues to bring about positive change in the culture of the community and raise awareness about the orphans and their needs in order to ensure a better life for them and their families.
Yehala from around the world comes as a message to the whole world that Palestine is also part of the world. Therefore, this message reaches the world that the crossings should be open to facilitate traveling for our children and us, so we can visit these countries and communicate widely with the neighboring and other countries.
The Israeli blockade of the occupied Gaza Strip in its current form has been in place since June 27, when Israel imposed a full-scale land, sea, and air blockade on the area. The siege contravenes Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits collective punishment that it prevents the realization of a broad range of human rights. Three Gaza children died in 2022 as a result of the Israeli occupation authorities' delays or refusal to grant them permits to exit Gaza for medical treatment.
We hope such event has a positive effect on our students, and they are part of the history and the glory, and they are capable of breaking the siege and the Israeli blockade want to break their will. They have a great civilization, and this affects their psychological and social well-being.
The beleaguered Palestinians in Gaza live in a cycle of a struggle, located, imprisoned, and denied basic human rights and needs. Now entering its 18th year, the Israeli blockade created a generation seeing a window to the world outside. These kinds of events are a glimmer of hope for the children who one day want to break the siege and restore their right to freedom of movement. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Terrorism laundering, a term which Iran's foreign minister's two-day visit to Geneva will be remembered by. Addressing the 52nd session of the Human Rights Council at the UN headquarters, Hossein Amir Abdullahian did not mince his words when it came to elaborating on the fact that Iran had been a victim of an unprecedented propaganda war. He said the rights of the Iranian nation were completely ignored during that war, launched by the same countries claiming to be advocates of human rights.
The role of anti-Iran terrorist groups in the recent crisis in my country was evident. Some states were involved in terrorism laundering while applying double standard. They provided considerable financial and logistical facility to some violent and terrorist elements during the unrest. The UN human rights mechanisms could and should contribute to the promotion and protection of human rights through genuine dialogue, constructive interaction, and respectful capacity building cooperation.
Some European officials in particular, who then took the opportunity to meet with Amir Abdullahian. Several other meetings followed as well, involving officials from countries including Armenia, Indonesia, Senegal, and Venezuela, seeking stronger bilateral ties. Top UN officials also met with Iran's foreign minister, including Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Boosting cooperation was the key issue in the agenda of this pentilateral meeting. Iran is hosting over 5 million Afghan refugees, but international humanitarian organizations have not been offering any kind of help. On the other hand, unilateral sanctions have also exacerbated the situation of these Afghan refugees. The next session of this pentalateral meeting will be held in Tehran to discuss the situation further.
The UN Secretary General was informed of the efforts that Iran has made to solve the problems in Yemen, and Mr. Guterres demanded that we continue our efforts. Regarding Ukraine, Iran's stance was clarified. Iran is ready to use its potential for initiating a peace process. Iran's cooperation with the IAEA and the upcoming visit of the agency's delegation was also discussed in the meeting.
An issue that was reiterated by the foreign minister during the 2023 Conference on Disarmament, which started on the same day the 22nd session of the Human Rights Council was held, allowing the issue of human rights to be discussed in more detail.
We have several agenda items. We have more than 40 or 50 themes and around the same number of country situations that will be discussed over the course of this session. It is also a sign of the importance, I would say, that states and NGOs attach to the Human Rights Council as a venue to discuss issues which are often not heard in other venues. So it's incredibly significant.
This year marks 75 years since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and 30 years since the adoption of the Vienna Declaration, two milestone documents that continue to guide the work of the Council. But it is very clear that we still have a long way to go.
The 52nd session of the Human Rights Council started on February 27th and will continue until April the 4th. Key issues on the agenda include the three P's: promotion, protection, and prevention. Promotion of human rights, protection of those who fight for human rights, and preventing human rights from being violated. Gisum Isha Ahmadi, the Human Rights Headquarters in Geneva.
Years after Brexit, they're still talking about it. One big sticking point, the post-Brexit Northern Ireland Protocol for Trade, legislation that at one point threatened the Good Friday Peace Agreement and pushed the EU and UK to the brink of a trade war. Officials on both sides of the dispute now claim they have found a solution to the problem, and they have a name for it too.
The Windsor Framework delivers free-flowing trade within the whole United Kingdom. It protects Northern Ireland's place in our union, and it safeguards sovereignty for the people of Northern Ireland.
Under the new deal, there will be two routes for goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK. A green route with minimal checks for goods, which will stay in Northern Ireland, and a red one for goods which may continue into the EU after going through EU checks. Disputes will be settled by Northern Ireland courts, but some could still go to the European Court of Justice. And if new EU single market regulations are introduced, the UK government could veto them if the Northern Ireland Assembly has voted for that to happen.
We are now seeing part of the United Kingdom, namely the North of Ireland, essentially being re-invited back into aspects of the EU. And that is a very big statement. And I'm sure that Brussels is hoping this will begin to disintegrate the overall Brexit deal.
The details of the deal are yet to emerge, but Prime Minister Sunak faces two challenges. One is to get the approval of the Democratic Unionists in Northern Ireland, who have refused to enter a power-sharing government with Sinn Féin nationalists for months over the Boris Johnson-era protocol, which has created a sea border between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK.
The Unionists have a set of tests that have to be passed or they'll back out of it. Now, that's an insurance policy. They don't want to lose votes. They don't want to look like they've sold out the Unionist agenda. And that makes political sense for them. The big test for Sunak, more than anything else, is whether he can get all sides to give a tick in the box.
In Westminster, meantime, the Prime Minister has briefed his cabinet, who seem to be on side.
The Prime Minister's next challenge would be winning the approval of the Eurosceptic Conservative members of the ERG, the European Research Group in the building behind me, who have already said that the revised bill does not go far enough, which means that the deal is not quite done yet. Saeed Bourizza, London.
The indefinite strike, which began nationwide on January 4th in protest at the Dina Boluarte administration, remains strong in the southern regions of Peru, with major road closures in several provinces, according to the Ground Transport Authority. Nearly all of the civilians that have been reported killed since the December 7th ouster of President Castillo lost their lives in anti-government protests in this part of the country.
It's mainly the people in the countryside who are mistreated. We cry daily for our sons who have been killed, as many as 70 people by this government, and they still haven't acknowledged that they did it. They haven't said who was killed.
A newly released Ipsos poll finds that nationally, 51% of Peruvians believe that Pedro Castillo was ousted in a parliamentary coup, a number which surges to 69% in rural areas like here in the Puno region.
Particularly in Puno, they have marginalized us a lot. They have said that we are terrorists, that we are vandals, and that we are just Indians. We are going to continue fighting. I believe the strike will continue until Dina Boluarte resigns, as well as the rest of the Congress.
A preliminary report released this week by the International Human Rights and Solidarity Mission outlines numerous human rights abuses and calls for an investigation of the Peruvian state for crimes against humanity, for its excessive use of force against a defenseless civilian population and using lethal weapons.
I want justice to be served and for the whole world to find out everything that we are going through here. I want everyone to know so that there is justice for our children who have died.
Around the country, the popular call continues to be the demand for the resignation of Dina Boluarte, as well as immediate presidential elections. Camila Escalante, Desaguadero.
Consumer Association Federconsumatori has rung the alarm bell over the growing financial difficulties Italian families are faced with. Federconsumatori National Observatory has found that one out of four families in Italy is struggling to cope with high inflation and rising cost of living. This, as the Bureau of Statistics Istat has estimated, a timid comeback in consumer confidence in February. According to Federconsumatori, an increasing number of Italians are giving up on food quality to save money.
Today, as the cost of living crisis has eroded families' purchasing power, we have recorded a 17% drop in the purchase of meat and fish and a 13% drop in the consumption of fruit and vegetables. We had asked the government to introduce significant supporting measures for the Italian families, but unfortunately our calls went utterly unheard.
Prices in Italy rose more than 8% year on year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in nearly 40 years when the lira currency was in use. According to Istat, Italy's annual inflation rate registered a slowdown in January, dropping to 10% from 11.6% in December. However, the situation has turned dire for many in the country.
The cost of living went up big way, too much for a young student like me. Prices have doubled over the past months.
The cost of staple food items, basic ingredients, has gone crazy, and also the cost of energy. To me, it's a theft by the government.
According to analysts, high energy prices have been the main drivers for the bulk of those increases, pushed higher by the energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war. The poverty rate increased significantly in Italy in 2020-2022 period. In 2021, some 2 million families lived in absolute poverty, a figure accounting for over 5.5 million people that is destined to grow. Max Civili, Rome.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn...
Allahu Akbar, Allah, kulli shay'in wa akbar.
يا إله كل شيء ومليك يا رب.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
يا خالق كل شيء ووارث.
Today's interesting tip: what will happen on the Day of Judgment if our prayers and our ubudiyah, our service, our worship, and our obedience to Allah is not accepted? So, dear listeners, we are talking about this idea that when the Day of Judgment comes around, what if, God forbid, our worship and our salah, our different various forms of ubudiyah, our service, our obedience, and our worship to the Almighty Allah is not accepted? Now, of course, we should always have hope that despite the fact that our worship is a worship which is incomplete, it is flawed, it has errors in it, and most of all, this worship that we do is not up to par, and it is not what the Almighty Allah actually deserves. For the unlimited power and glory and majesty of the Almighty Allah makes it incumbent upon us human beings to also worship that Almighty Allah and to have ubudiyah to that Almighty Allah as He deserves. But that is not possible, right? For we are human beings and we are in the shackles of existence and in the shackles of time and age and error and forgetfulness and such things. So, of course, we must always realize that this is what the value of our worship is. But of course, we try to continue to make our worship valuable and be able to give something in the presence of the Almighty Allah as ubudiyah to the Almighty Allah. Now, keeping this in mind and, of course, having hope that our efforts and our sincere efforts, of course, will be accepted by the Almighty Allah. At the same time, we must keep in mind that there is a possibility that our worship and our ubudiyah and our salah, which of course is the mi'raj of the mu'min, might not be accepted. Now, of course, a salah or a ubudiyah which does not bring us close to the sacred proximity to the divine presence of the Almighty Allah won't be accepted. The whole purpose of the salah and the ubudiyah is to bring us close to the sacred proximity of the divine presence of the Almighty Allah. And if this is not happening in one way or the other, whether in a small amount or a large amount, then it means that our worship and our ubudiyah is not being effective. And something that is not being effective, of course, means that there are some kind of flaws or errors within it. Now, when we come to the Day of Judgment, we come to the Day of Resurrection, of course, there isn't much that we can do. The Day of Action was in this very world, and the Day of Reaping what we sowed, that is the Day of the Hereafter. And truly, what a shame it will be if we reach that day and we realize that our ubudiyah was not accepted by the Almighty Allah.
شربنا على فكري
حبيبي مدامتا
ساكرنا بها من قال
لأن يخلق الكرم.
IRIB English Radio.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Khalil Jaafar.
Human beings have two distinct natures that are often confused and seen as one. And that recognizing these two natures in a human being as two distinct natures is crucial for anyone's spiritual growth and development. We cannot evolve spiritually unless we recognize these two natures. The first nature is what we call tabi'a. We come to this world, we all know that our stay in this world is temporary. We acknowledge this time and time again, that we have come to this world for a trial, we have come to this world for a test, we've come here for a short while, this is not our final abode, we will die and go to our permanent homes. We know this. To survive that physical experience on this planet, so to speak, we have a physical body. This physical body is driven by an instinct, an animal-like instinct. And it is this nature, this animal-like nature that we call tabi'a, animal instinct or nature, that is similarly found in animals just as it is found in us. For example, animals spend all day foraging for food. We do the same. They might roam around in jungles and forests hunting animals. We wear a suit and sit in our cars and drive on the highway, but we're still foraging for food. We see that in our eating habits, in our sleeping habits, in how we reproduce, in how we relieve ourselves, in our physical nature, in how we're constantly in search of pleasure or fleeing from pain or fighting for survival, we are no different from the other creatures and species on this planet. And this is the result of that nature that is called tabi'a. In order to ensure that we do not forget our true identity, that we are not the physical self, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has then wired us with a far more superior nature that is more innate, that is more deeply ingrained in us, and that is called fitrah. Now fitrah as well, sometimes we translate it as instinct. But here when we speak of fitrah, we will define it as a divinely inspired nature that is unique to human beings. And it is this fitrah that is mentioned in the verse of Quran, that from Surah Ar-Rum, chapter 30 of the Quran, فَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ لِلدِّينِ حَنِيفًا. Set your heart, set your faces, set your direction upon the pure faith, upon this deena hanifa. فِطْرَةَ اللَّهِ الَّتِي فَطَرَ النَّاسَ عَلَيْهِ. That divine nature that Allah has set mankind on. فَطَرَ النَّاسَ عَلَيْهَا. لَا تَبْدِيلَ لِخَلْقِ اللَّهِ. You will not find any change or any alteration in how Allah has created this. ذَلِكَ الدِّينُ الْقَيِّمُ. That is the upright religion. وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. But most people do not know this. So there is an emphasis here that your understanding of religion as well, when we say Islam is the most natural religion, Islam does not oppose human nature. What we mean is it does not oppose your fitrah. We do not mean it does not oppose your tabi'ah. So in other words, our fitrah is a compass within all of us that always points to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير
يا الله يا رحمن حقق أمانينا وفقنا في كل آن في مساعينا.
Welcome back to your listeners. In continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea regarding that, God forbid, in the hereafter and on the Day of Judgment, we realize that all of our prayers and our worship and our ubudiyah was not accepted by the Almighty Allah. Now, in the previous segment, of course, we talked about how we must have hope in the fact that the Almighty Allah will accept our worship and our ubudiyah. But at the same time, we must be realistic and realize that our worship and our ubudiyah, even if it is at the level, at a very high level, it's still not what is deserving of the Almighty Allah. The Almighty Allah deserves much, much more than that. But still, we come to a point now where we say, you know, if we didn't pay attention, if we didn't try hard enough, if we didn't give due focus, if we did not give due diligence to our worships and our ubudiyah, what will be our share on that day when we find that it was not accepted? Except for regret and remorse and helplessness and wretchedness and shame and disgrace, and a regret and a remorse which would have no equal in this world, because we spent all our lives doing a hollow ubudiyah, an empty ubudiyah, a ubudiyah which was not sincere, it was not pure, it was not for the sake of Allah. And we will be faced with a shame and a disgrace which cannot be imagined in worldly terms. Of course, the regrets of this world are at any rate mixed with a thousand kinds of hope, and yet the shamelessness that is here in this world is transitory. It is not permanent, but the regret and the remorse of the hereafter is permanent. And on that day, what hope is there when we realize that we spent a life of ubudiyah that was not accepted by the All-Merciful and the Most Forgiving, the Almighty Allah? In order to prevent ourselves from facing such a calamity and disaster of epic proportions, we must try our best to, in this world, do the best kind of ubudiyah that we can, the best kind of service and worship and obedience to the Almighty Allah that we can, and at the same time have hope that the Almighty Allah will find it in His grace to accept our ubudiyah despite its faults and its errors. And also that we must ask for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah for the errors and the lapses in our ubudiyah, so that every single one of us can be a shining light in the hereafter, and may Allah accept the service, the obedience, the worship, and the ubudiyah of every single one of us by the sake and in the name of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. الذي أحتمي بحماه حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. This is part of Tehran's efforts to diversify its trade and economic relations in the face of increasing sanctions by the West. The Islamic Republic has been pursuing the policy of expanding relations with a look towards the East in particular, while also aiming to grow trade ties with Africa and Latin America. In tonight's program, we'll discuss the extent to which Iran has been successful in this regard with our guests. Academic and political analyst Bruno Beclini joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. We also have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Start off with Mr. Beclini in Porto Alegre. It's great to have you with us, both of you gentlemen. Mr. Beclini, Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. How do you view the significance of such a step?
Well, first of all, it will be a reference for the whole maritime freight and commerce between Latin America and the Islamic Republic. Because it's very difficult, for example, for Brazilian exporters to get maritime freight to Iran. And also, the majority of the major of the bulks and the vessels of the merchant fleet from Iran is more dedicated to the Asian continent. So it's a great notice. Also, it includes a question of security, maritime security, considering that the Atlantic and the South Atlantic, it is the majority of the Navy operating there is Anglo-Saxon, being U.S. or Great Britain Navy. They surrounded the Atlantic Southern Ocean from Latin America to Africa, and this is a great notice, even more because, as far as I know, these bulks will also go through South Africa, increasing the commerce between other BRICS country like South Africa.
John Bozich, the shipping line has been launched as Iran and Venezuela pledge to boost bilateral ties in various fields. They just signed a 20-year strategic agreement to expand cooperation on energy and agriculture, among other things. Now, both countries, as we know, are under U.S. sanctions and have been looking for alternatives to neutralize that pressure. It looks like the more the U.S. tries to crank up the pressure, the target countries, they manage to come up with more opportunities.
Well, actually, that's the case. During the 1990s, when the United States put sanctions here on Serbia, Serbia developed entire new industries and autonomous production inside the country, eliminating the need for many Western imports. The same thing, of course, has happened with Cuba, and we now hear that Russia is a net agricultural exporter after many decades of having to import agricultural products. So what we're seeing is not just isolated results that are successful, but a blanket response of productivity, autonomy, and independence economically as a result of American sanctions. There is nothing other to say except that these sanctions have backfired and they have united the world against the United States.
Mr. Beclini, the Iranian embassy in Venezuela says that one ship will be sent to Venezuela every 3 months. What kind of a response are you expecting to see from the U.S. in this regard? If you recall back in 2020, when Iran sent oil tankers to Venezuela, Washington had threatened to prevent Venezuela from receiving the ships from Iran. Now, much to the dissatisfaction of the U.S., those ships were received by Venezuela. What about now?
Everything is possible when we think about the so-called hawks living in Washington, D.C. Their capabilities are very, very wide one, and the morality allows them to do everything. Anything is possible and it's unpredictable. But as far as I believe in Latin America capacity of self-defense and autonomous diplomacy, I don't think that Biden administration would dare to do this regarding what is happening now in Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Bolivia. We are much more self-determined than we would be 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. It will be a hardcore situation for them, allowing the sovereign command, the military combatant commando permanent that they put to project power against us in Latin America, to frighten and to do this, I would say, piracy against Iranian vessels. I don't think they will dare like this, but considering U.S. policies, everything is possible.
Mr. Bosnich, let's look at this in the bigger picture. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, had promised a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. Iran seems to be moving in that very direction. Now, a 25-year strategic agreement was recently signed between Tehran and China. What would a boost in economic, energy, and trade relations between Tehran and Beijing mean?
Obviously, this is going to lead to a greater level of integration in other areas other than just energy. China has a great number of technologies and productive capacities that will be of interest and of great use to Iran. Iran also has its excellent drone technologies and military defense technologies that it is certainly more than willing to share with countries facing similar pressure from the United States. I'd also like to predict right now that the one boat every 3 months is going to become one boat every month with Venezuela. And after the first 2 months, it's going to become one boat every week, because the natural flow of trade between countries under sanctions can only explode exponentially. Because these countries have the right to trade, they have the right under the World Trade Organization to trade, and the United States cannot legally sanction or block trade between two independent countries on the open seas.
Mr. Bosnich, I'm going to stay with you. You mentioned the issue of integration. Iran, as we also know, was recently granted full membership at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO. How significant is SCO membership of Iran? What are the implications for Iran across the board economically and diplomatically, and what does it mean for Iran to be an SCO member? How can a stronger, what can a stronger SCO do in particular for the region?
Well, let's compare the, let's say, rival economic groupings around the world. We've got the North American Free Trade Agreement, which is basically a resource rape by the United States from Mexico and Canada. Being a Canadian, I know that firsthand. In the EU, we have former colonial powers trying to make a go of it without the resources that they need locally, and they're doing very, very poorly, as we see with the energy crisis and the insanity of blowing up their own fuel lines in cooperation with the United States. So there's no doubt that the SCO is about to become, if not already, the world's single largest and most important economic cooperation organization. And with the increase of economic cooperation, we're going to see cultural, political, and military cooperation to protect their domestic territory and their rights. I'm looking at the SCO as being the major element in the pendulum shift on this planet toward the east.
Mr. Beklini, Iran says that it's expanding relations with a look towards the east in particular, while also eyeing growing trade ties with Africa and with Latin America. How important can these expansions be?
It's it's a huge importance because for us, for example, in Brazil, Iran is a middle power ranked in the same level as Brazil, a little bit more in high tech, a little bit less in agriculture, for example. And we can expect for another situation. So Iran expanding commerce, trade, and also a kind of soft power on our societies, it will embrace a part, a portion of the elite in Latin America who has Arab descendancy. I insist on this. Only in Brazil, we are 16 million Arab descendants. We have the vice president. We have the minister of economy. We have the minister of planning. It's not a small thing to deal with. So Iran working in trade in Africa, in Latin America, can embrace a part of the ruling class of those countries to look to the East as a solution to get rid of the U.S. dollar as the international currency and the threats of the sanctions coming from Washington, for example.
And the same question that we had for Mr. Bozic, I'm going to bring it to you, Mr. Beklini, as well. How do you perceive the functionality of an organization like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, with Iran as a member?
It's wonderful. It's a huge challenge because the SCO and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, it can establish a new pattern of international trade. For example, putting in concrete the dream of Lord Keynes of having the Bancor, an international currency without being connected to a central bank like it was first of all in England during the 19th century and then with the U.S. Federal Bank Service, the Fed. So the SCO can expand the trade between Asia and from Asia to Africa and to Latin America. The most important thing that we must understand in international trade, international system, is that we cannot allow anymore the U.S. to be the police of the world. We cannot allow anymore them to say which country will be inside the SWIFT system and which country will without the SWIFT system. We must expand the systems, the banking system, to get rid of U.S. dollar as international currency and to get rid of the SWIFT system. That's a must-be situation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
John Bozic, these advancements now at the time of the toughest sanctions ever on Iran have led to Iran becoming more and more self-sufficient. Has the maximum pressure campaign and sanctions regime not been successful?
Well, I mean, unless Iran has its man in Washington who's organizing these sanctions to help Iran become independent, no. The United States is behaving like a bully. And that's what they are. They pretend to be the global policeman, but actually what they are is the global bully. And we know, all of us, from our primary school days in school, that there is usually a bully. And the bully uses his brute force against several weaker people that he finds in his class until he runs into one who is not going to be pushed around. The Americans have run into Russia. They have run into China, and they have now run into Iran. And they are not going to be able to push around neither Russia nor China nor Iran. And this is the way the bully is brought into line. And if necessary, this is the way that the bully is brought down.
Mr. Beklini, Tehran First of all, the issue bringing countries together, which was mentioned by Mr. Bozic. The Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, has stressed that his country's foreign policy, meaning Iran, is based on opposition to unilateralism. Now, what countries like Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, and a number of other countries they surely have in common is opposition to unilateralism. So are the U.S. sanctions and Washington's enmity actually binding more countries together?
No, of course not. They're trying to subordinate the European Union, and they have succeeded in it, promoting and escalating the war in Ukraine and getting out of the Minsk agreement. And they are also, for example, the Southern Command, they want to put their hands on the lithium in Chile, Argentina, and especially in Bolivia. And Bolivia does have an agreement with China to benefit the lithium and to start, for example, a nuclear energy system for medicine in Bolivia, like what happened in Iran. They will do whatever they can to sabotage the Brazilian diplomatic effort to do peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. And even the comedian, the Zelensky, wants to be in a peace talk with Brazilian diplomacy between them and Moscow. Washington is desperate to provoke as long as more conflicts as they can do this. For example, in the Pacific Ocean, the permanent example that they are provoking instability in Latin America, they are allowing the coup d'etat in Peru, for example. So I would say that unilateralism only promotes betraying elite ruling class against their own countries and promote even more war and more dissent in the international system.
John Bozic, on another note, Tehran says allegations concerning Iran's nuclear activities and its lack of transparency with the IAEA are a continuation of Washington's destructive policies, i.e. spreading Iranophobia. Is Washington, in your opinion, trying to spin this to justify the lethal and deadly sanctions that affect the people of Iran?
Well, I would go beyond saying that they're spinning this, because when you spin something, it's partially true, and you augment the true part, that minority aspect, and you diminish the majority aspect, which is false. They're not spinning the story against Iran, they're fabricating it. Iran is a signatory to the necessary agreements on nuclear power and nuclear generation. Iran complied with and placed cameras to watch its operations in nuclear purification of the nuclear materials for power generation. Iran invited inspectors, and yet the United States continually maintained the lie that Iran was non-compliant. And they did all of this as if all of us were blind. Because at the very same time, America's only real ally in the Middle East, Israel, is a non-signatory to these control agreements and is already a nuclear power, as the whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu revealed in Israel before they put him away for 18 years in solitary confinement for revealing Israel's illegal nuclear weapons program.
Bruno Buccini, talking about lack of transparency, it's the Israelis who are known as the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the West Asian region. They enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. They are not signatories to the NPT, as mentioned by Mr. Bozic right now. They do not cooperate with the IAEA. They're believed to have a clandestine atomic weapons program. How dangerous can this lack of transparency be, which is never mentioned by the U.S. and its allies?
We must remember what happened during the 1973 war against the Zionist entity. The former passed-by minister Golda Meir, she threatened to throw an atomic bomb against the Cairo. The biggest threat against humanity nowadays is the reactor that they do have in Dimona, in the Negev Desert. Colin Powell, also former commander-in-chief of the U.S. forces and passed by also, he said, he written, that the Israeli they do have at minimum 200 missiles and ogives, and they maybe do have 300 bombs. So the Zionist entity is the biggest threat to the whole humanity, talking about nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. And I would like to think so that, can we imagine Cuba reinstalling nuclear missiles in the island? What Washington would do nowadays? But they are threatening to install nuclear missiles around the Ukrainian frontier, for example, or even more inside from Ukraine. They would like to do this. So I would say that Israeli atomic bombs and atomic program is the open secret of the whole world. And the hypocrisy of the Western societies and the Western media, they are denying the facts and also putting the finger against Iran and other middle powers that only want to be sovereign and self-determined countries and societies.
Sure. John Bozich, on the Israeli nuclear weapons, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has said this is an outstanding example of hypocrisy, dual standards, and discriminatory policies of various U.S. administrations. How has this hypocrisy been ignored and overlooked?
Well, first of all, you're right, it's hypocrisy, and that's hypocrisy with a capital H, as in hydrogen bomb, not just nuclear weapons. The Israeli military program for nuclear weapons includes hydrogen bombs. That means the maximum nuclear capacity that exists. And this is not a rumor. It is not an allegation. It is a proven fact, because scientist Mordecai Vanunu, an Israeli nuclear scientist, revealed this and broke this story in Europe on the run, and he was kidnapped by Israeli military intelligence and taken back to Israel, where he was tried and convicted to 18 years to life in prison. And he was not allowed to meet with, speak to anybody for literally two decades. So that is not what you do with somebody who tells a rumor. Israel is a leading international nuclear power. That's the fact of the matter. The situation now is that America cannot continue to lie about this, and it cannot continue to have a double standard toward Iran unless it wants to cut itself off from the entire world. And that's what it looks like America is doing, step by step, backwards to their little territory.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Academic and political analyst Bruno Beclini joining us from Porto Alegre, Brazil. And journalists, activists, and political analysts John Bozich joining us from Belgrade. Also, special thanks.